So this last month, we've been thinking, haven't we, briefly about the idea that Jesus is going to return. So this time of year, we're almost there, the big C system, that season that we all love, Christmas. Oh, you miserable lot, aren't you? Christmas. Yay! We're going to do it one more time. Christmas. Yay! Yeah, well, that's enough. Right, okay. So Christmas is coming, and you know, that at Christmas, we remember the first coming of Christ, the Advent, Jesus as a baby in a manger. But as Christians, we believe that he will come again. It's often called the second Advent or the second coming. And this time, he won't come as a baby in a manger, but he will come as a king in all his glory. And that's the sort of, sometimes we talk about that subject as the end times as well. If you've been a Christian, you've been around Christian circles, you'll have heard that phrase. And often it's a very sort of big and scary subject, if you like. So we've been trying to sort of address that and thinking about that. We thought about the basics are that we currently live in what's called the church age, where there is heaven and earth is experientially separated. Then we believe Jesus will come again, and there's loads of different theories about how that works, so I've chosen to be a coward and avoid talking about them, okay, on a Sunday morning, but maybe we can do that another time. And then after that, there will be a judgment, and in that judgment, we believe that there will be sort of two main pathways to that judgment. One is that if somebody is a believer in Jesus, has a relationship with Jesus, and we thought quite a bit about that last week, didn't we, then that they go into the eternity of God and are with him experientially. That's called eternal life, and we're told that's given us as a gift in Christ. If we don't know him in this life, then the other side of that judgment is what's sometimes referred to as hell or the separation from God. And again, I mentioned that there's two streams of thought with that. One is that that goes on forever and ever, and that people are conscious in that for all eternity of their separation from God. Or the other train of thought, which is one that I think I embrace, is that though there is a consciousness of a sense of loss and pain after death for those who don't know Christ, that at some point that ends and that they cease to exist. And so those are the basics, if you like, in terms of the way that we think about that. We've chosen to address that really by thinking about Jesus's sort of main teaching on that, Matthew 24 and 25, in which Jesus' disciples come to him and say to him, tell us when this is going to happen and let us know the signs so that we can get ready for when it happens. And that's basically the question that we want to know, really, isn't it? Now, when's it going to happen, and how do we know when it's coming? And Jesus purposely doesn't give them a clear answer, but he does give them something of an answer. He basically says to them, in terms of Jerusalem, you'll know when it's coming, when the armies are surrounding the city, and that all took place in AD 70. But in terms of when I'm coming back, nobody's going to know. It's going to catch you by surprise, and we can't fix a date on that. And then he basically says, you know, there's some things you've got to be careful of. He says, don't allow yourself to get racked with fear, even when you see awful things happening around the world. Don't let your love grow cold for me. So as this says him to go on, don't get cold, and be careful that you're not deceived. And that's really interesting that Jesus seems to say that this whole subject of the end, the second coming of Jesus and the end times and the way that all works, that it is a fertile ground for weird and wacky thinking. And so he's saying, be careful what you embrace as you approach this stuff. And if you've been a Christian for some time, you'll have heard lots of odd things around this particular subject. And then Jesus switches it around and says, actually, I've got some things I want to talk to you about. And he spends most of his time talking to them about how they can be prepared for that happening. And he tells them basically three parables, three stories, and one that maybe is a parable, maybe the sheep and the story of the sheep and the goats. Whether that's a parable or not, we can discuss. So the first one is he basically is talking to his closest followers, his apostles, the 12, and he says to them, you leaders in my kingdom, you've got to make sure that you are ready and you look out, you fulfill the duties that I give to you. So if you're a leader, that you keep on leading well and you don't get slothful in that and you don't start abusing your position in leadership. And so he talks to them about that. We haven't really sort of dug into that too much, but last week we then, next is the parable of the 10 virgins. And this essence of that that we looked at last week is that Jesus is going to know when we return, the first question, the first issue is, do we know him? And there were five that Jesus says he did know and five that he said he didn't know. And those that didn't know him didn't get invited into the eternity of God with him. And so he's basically saying, get yourself prepared. He's saying some people might look like they are part of the church community. They might look like they're part of this whole equation, might think that they are doing all the right things. And some people will say, well, I've done great things for you, God. I've done this for you. I've done that for you. And that idea that is so prevalent that somehow we earn our way into God's heaven. Jesus is saying that's not going to be the crux of the matter. The crux of the matter is whether or not you know me, whether you've met me. And we thought about that last week. The next parable that he talks to them about is the parable of the talents. And that's the one I'd like us to think about today. Story of the talents. And it's interesting that Jesus just tells these stories. Do you know Osman, the chap that we were praying for just now, a little while ago, he texted me and said, can you pray for us this week? I'm going visiting people from my tribe. His tribe will be quite a remote community. And he said... And he almost apologized for saying, he said, I can't teach the Bible to them. I've just got to tell them stories because they're a storytelling community. And isn't it sad that he felt he had to apologize for telling stories when the greatest Bible teacher, the greatest communicator, I think, ever, Jesus, basically told stories lots of the time. So then Jesus tells these stories to help us to connect with the way that we need to be prepared. So, parable of the talents. Is that okay? Matthew 25, verses 14 to 30. Does somebody fancy reading this for me? Brilliant. Give you a rest from my voice for a minute.
Parable of the talents. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey, called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who'd received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who'd received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who'd received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with the 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who'd received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I know that you're a hard man, harvesting where you haven't sown and gathering where you've not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For everyone who has been given more, and he will have an abundance. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. Throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Brilliant. Thank you, Andy. Great. Cheers. So, just to say, when we read the word talent in there, you know, in our English vocabulary, we immediately think of abilities, don't we? And but actually, what he was talking talents in those days was a unit of money, if you like. So he's basically the story here is of a master who's going on a journey, and he basically gives to his servants, literally the language there is slaves, doulos is slave, gives to his slaves some money to work with. And he expects them to do something with that money. To one he gives 10, one he gives 5, one he gives 1, and you've got the story. So I want to just sort of think about this. We're going to be fairly simple today because I appreciate I've gone quite heavy with some of this series that we've looked at this month. And two main sort of areas I want to think about here with this. One is, what's the sort of crux of this story, really? And then I want to think about the thing that maybe will stop us engaging with what Jesus would look like us to take from this. So for me, the first thought that I want to just play with for a moment is that the master is obviously meant to represent God, isn't it, in this story? and the slaves are meant to represent us. And it seems to me that the first thing that Jesus wants to get there is that God gives resources to each one of us according to our capacity, but he expects us to do something with those resources that he gives us. He expects us to grow them. First thing is that I am really glad that God gives to us according to our abilities, that he realizes that we all have different capacities. He's not going to ask you to do that which you cannot do. You know, there are some people that you meet, you know, the 10 talent people, the people who can speak 10 languages fluently, you know, who can who run marathons, who, you know, work out 5-7 days a week, you know, who can cook in 6 different languages as well, you know, and all those sorts of things. Read, you know, history, Greek, and science, and do all those sorts of things, and then they go to school and they really start learning, you know, when they're 5 years old. You know, you meet people like that, don't you? Have just got this huge capacity, and then you meet other people, you know, a bit like most of us in the ordinary world, who struggle to just get everything done most days, you know. And God knows our capacity. He knows that some of us can handle a lot, and some of us can handle a little. And his expectation of us is linked to our capacity. So for each one of us here, God has given you resources. He's given you capacity according to your capacity. But he hasn't just given it to you. He expects you to do something with it. Can I have a granddad moment? Is that all right? Just for a couple of seconds. Can we have the video up? Is that all right? Come on, Adam. Nice to see Stina's mum this morning as well. Having a grandma moment there as well, aren't you? She's lovely, isn't she? Yeah. Great. So, quick. Here we go. Hey. Should we play it again? Start again. Go on, I can talk us through it then. Go on, play it again. It's only 7 seconds, this. Rory's almost starting to... Rory, in case you don't know, this is my grandson, Rory. In case you haven't heard me mention that, you know. See, Rory has just started to walk, you know, but he doesn't know how far he can walk. And Rory doesn't know that he's about to start. So he just needs a little bit of coaxing, doesn't he? You know, he starts to wobble. I think he walks when you're not watching him, right? Noticed he was around yesterday. He was wandering around. I'm sure he was doing some Irish dancing in the corner as well, you know. But Rory's just starting to walk, but he needs coaxing. He doesn't know that he can walk yet. Do you know what I mean? He needs that sort of encouraging forward. And we all do that with our kids, don't we? That they start to wobble around and then you coax them and they're moving forward. And I think that perhaps that's the sort of image that we've got here of God investing in us. He gives us things and we think, well, I can't do much about it. So although he's investing in us according to our capabilities, I think he also invests in us with a view to stretching us. And if you're a Christian in this room today, I would suggest there is a sense in which God is stretching you in some area of your life. There is some way in which God is stretching you forward. Those are the moments when it all feels a little bit like, oh, I can't do this. But let me say to you, you probably can. It's probably God is a little bit like me with Rory holding that. I held the duck in the air. I don't know if you noticed that. Because if he's going for something up, it means he will reach up and walk. If I put the duck on the floor, he'll just crawl together. You know, God does that, doesn't he? He holds the duck so we can walk and stretch us forward a little bit. So I thought maybe it'd be helpful if we just spent a few moments around our tables, if that's all right, seeing as we are Cafe Church this morning, thinking about what resources, when we think about the idea of God, I want to translate that word talent into resources, okay, this morning, and just think, what resources do you think that God gives us? You know, what are the resources that you maybe identify in your own life, or you just think in general terms, generic terms, that God gives to us, that in one sense, he expects us to grow. Is that right? Can you do that for a few moments, very quickly, 2 or 3 minutes around your tables? If you don't want to do it, just sit there and have a think. That's fine as well. That's great. Brilliant. So tell me, what resources do you think God gives us then? Or do you think you have in your life, or just general?
Time.
Yeah, very good. Time is a resource, isn't it? And many people say that time's like money. It is, that once it's spent, isn't it, really? Others? Sorry? capacity in terms of your, yep, okay. All right, yeah.
In terms of faith and...
Yeah, okay. So is faith a resource? Maybe.
Probably, yes.
Yeah. Anything else? Anyone?
Empathy.
Empathy, very good. Yep, that's a resource. Sorry?
Hospitality,
very good. Yep. Anything else?
Strength,
courage. Sorry?
To love one another.
Love one another. Yeah, loving each other is a resource. It's good. These are all things I never thought of, actually, so it's good, isn't it?
Skills.
Skills, yeah, your personal skills. Yeah, brilliant.
Acceptance.
Sorry?
Acceptance.
Acceptance, yeah.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness, yeah.
Our brains.
Yeah, some of us have got more resource than others there.
Authority.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Safety.
Yeah. Good. Very good.
Knowing when to say no.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Great. Okay. So, yes.
To share Jesus with others.
I wouldn't have expected you to say anything else, Ruth. Brilliant. Okay. I mean, you've got loads that I didn't get there, actually. So, these are the sort of things I was thinking about. I mean, some of the things you've said are including that. Material things, what we have, everything that you own is a resource that you can choose to make available to God, isn't it, really? God doesn't take it from you, but he does have expectations of us. And I mean, I think if you can purchase a book, if you have enough money to buy a book, I think that puts you in something like the top... I've got these figures slightly wrong, I'm sure, but that puts you in something like the top 15% of the most wealthiest people in the world. If you can buy a book, you are one of the wealthiest people in the world. In our Western environment, we don't always think about that, do we? That we think globally, but yeah, so spiritual gifts, the things that God gives you that, you know, the things that you might, if you're somebody who knows your Bible, things like speaking in other languages or gifts of knowledge or healing or your gifts of administration, the things that you would say that you feel that God has given to you as a gift to do. Natural abilities, I think we touched on that here and there. So some of us are just good at some things, aren't we? You know, some people are great at skydiving or some people are good at surfing or whatever it may be. Is that a resource for God? Maybe you can turn it that way. Your physical well-being. Let me tell you that is a resource for God, and you become more conscious of that the more senior you become. The more you advance in years, you actually begin to think, oh, goodness me, some of my resources don't seem to switch quite so easily as they used to. Our opportunities, you know, our education, we touched on that, you know, if you have access to education, it is a resource that you can use, and our social settings, and just who you are, you know, you are lovely, just as you are. Oh, so it's, I suppose the point is, that I just want to see, is that each of us have a whole, you know, and as we just illustrated, going around the room there, there's loads of different thoughts about what resources can be. But Jesus seems to be saying to us that when he returns, when we come to that final judgment as Christians, there's going to be one question he's going to ask us. What did you do with what I gave you? Did you grow it? Did you make something of it? And the question today, I suppose, I have to ask all of us quite simply is, are you making the most of the resources that you have in your world right now? Are you doing something with them? You know, we haven't touched on things like environmental issues, have we? We haven't touched on things, you know, at the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, when God creates humanity, he tells them to rule the earth and to subdue it. Part of what humanity is always meant to do is to represent the activity of God in the world, to work the ground and to grow the resources. And so God, it has always been part of God's purposes for us that we are given responsibility and we're meant to represent the life and the activity of God in the world in which we live. And part of the thinking of the second coming and the kingdom to come and heaven and all of that is part of returning to God's original intention for us. So, next train of thoughts, loads of things I'm not going to get into there. So, next sort of areas I want to just play around with for a few moments is, what is it that stops us growing what God has given us? And it seems to me that there's three thoughts that Jesus puts in there. I'm going to have to go on these very, very superficially, but you can think about them in your own week, in your own time this week, perhaps. Is poor view of God. You know, this particularly revolves around the last person, the one with the one talent, who says, you know, I was scared stiff of you, Governor. So I went and I hid it in the ground, and because I know that you reap where you do not sow, you know, so the image, and so when the master comes back, he says, you wicked, lazy servant, you could have at least put it in the bank and got some interest, you know. So thinking around that part of the story, it seems to me that Jesus is saying there's three things that can stop us growing what God has given us. One is a poor view of God. See, this slave didn't know his master very well, did he? His thinking of his master was wrapped up in very negative views. And so then the master says to him, you are lazy and you're wicked. You're going to think about them in reverse, really. So the idea of wickedness, what is perhaps that? That's a really horrible word, isn't it? Wicked. You know, it seems really harsh. But that same word in the original language there, you know, the New Testament was written in Greek, and the original language there, that was the same word that when Jesus taught his disciples to pray that we should be delivered from evil, it's the same word there. So we could translate the word wicked for evil there, you evil. So perhaps what is loaded in that question is the idea of values. What is it that this slave, this servant, valued? And it seems that he didn't value investing what God had given him. He didn't value trying to make it grow. He didn't value working hard. He didn't value trying to be fruitful. He obviously had other values. Values perhaps such as we're going to see in a moment, laziness. Values which maybe included the idea that he just couldn't be bothered. See, our values shape who we are, don't they? Some values, we just learn them unconsciously. But just by living in this country at this time, there are values that are part of your world that you wouldn't even know you're embracing. We just get infected with them. Somebody comes along one day and talks to us about it, and a light switches on, and you think, do you know, I didn't even know I did that. I didn't even know I thought that. And we all carry values, don't we? And some values are good, and some values we learn consciously. We think, well, I'm going to try and be like that. We hear somebody talk about something, or we read something. And so fundamentally, I would suggest to you that we as Christians should draw our values from the Scriptures. And in particular, we should draw our values from the teachings of Jesus. And perhaps in particular, if you really want to get narrowed down to the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount was one of the most radically transforming teachings that humanity has ever known. You know, Gandhi was not a Christian, but known for all his goodwill towards humanity and his pacifistic approach in the face of violence and the like. You know, drew a lot of his thinking from the Sermon on the Mount and what Jesus was teaching there. And so, our values, how do they affect what we do with the resources that we have? So for instance, if we're talking about material resources, and Jesus teaches us to hold them lightly. He teaches us to give rather than to value giving more than receiving. Is that going to affect how we grow things? Jesus teaches us to love those that hate us and persecute us. Is that going to affect how we grow? So am I going to be kind to the person who's not kind to me? Am I going to be the one who's going to stop the cycle of hatred and violence when that seems to be going round and round and round? Am I going to be the one who takes the initiative and grows love? That was one of the values, or kindness, or forgiveness. Am I going to be growing those things? So values, what we value is going to affect what we do with the resources that we have, perhaps. Next is laziness. It makes sense, that, really, doesn't it? You're not going to grow, you think, if you're just like, you know, soaking up the Zeds all day, and that's your approach. I love this the book. I did a series here years ago, I think, on the Book of Proverbs, and one of them there was on what the Book of Proverbs called the sluggard. And really, in one sense, it was a picture of laziness. And some of the proverbs there are just, I think, are quite interesting. So the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the desires of the diligent are fully satisfied. Now, the lazy person just says, oh, I want it to happen. But the person who works hard makes it happen. There's a few actually in there that are quite interesting. I won't go through them all, really. I like the end one, really. But the sluggard says, there's a lion outside, or I will be murdered in the streets. In other words, the sluggard, the lazy person says, I can't go out there and do that. It's dangerous. I can't go out there or I might die. And if I work too hard, I might die. And it seems to me that the writer to the Proverbs of the proverb there is saying, deal with the lion. Deal with the thing that you think is stopping you stepping out and doing what you're meant to be doing. Deal with your laziness. That's the root of what he's saying there is whatever is causing you to not be diligent, whatever is causing you not to work hard. Think about it. But the one I want to really just spend a few moments thinking about is this idea of a poor view of God. I find this fascinating, this story, really, that the guy with the one talent, the beginning of his argument as to why he can't do what he should be doing with the resources that God had given him was that he thought his master was hard and harsh. It seems there are three thoughts there. One, that he thought that his master was hard. The other, that he thought he was unfair. And the whole thing, that it was fear-based. I love studying the sort of idea of the doctrine of God. It's one of the, I do this thing a couple of times a year at the Journey Academy in a church in Cambridge at C3. And they give me the sort of task of doing basic doctrines for a couple of days. And one of the things we do is the doctrine of God. And we think about, and what I try to do is to get them to think about how that is important when it comes to leadership. It's a leadership course. And I have to set them a question. So one of the questions is, how does our understanding of God affect the way that we lead? And so I tried to get them to, you can peel off factual statements about God is this and God is omnipresent, God is omnipotent, all powerful, God is omniscient, all knowing, and all those big words, which sounds really flash, doesn't it? But actually it doesn't really get us involved with the story of the Bible. Of a God who is involved in humanity, a God who gets involved with us, who walks the journey of life with us. And so to try and get the pulse on the way that God is. When Jesus walked into his social setting, when he was 30 years old and began his ministry in the way that he did, he walked into a society that was pretty much in a religious society that was dominated particularly by a group called the Pharisees, people who had a very rule-based approach to God, who basically had the law that was given to them in the Old Testament, and then they created a whole more laws. As if they didn't have enough laws, they created a whole more law, because they were so frightened of breaking God's law that they said, we need to build a fence around it. And so to build that fence around it so you can't even get close to breaking it, we'll have lots of other laws. So in other words, you can only take so many steps on the Sabbath. You have to wash your hands in a certain way, all sorts of things that were not in the expectation of God in the Old Testament. And so Jesus walked into that. And what that probably created, or certainly seemed to create, was a society that was scared stiff of God. That meant that the common person couldn't engage with this God. It was just way out there, not accessible to them. And we've cultivated that view of God through the years, haven't we? A God who is a God of a big stick, a God who wants to beat the life out of us. When I was at school, we had a teacher called Beaky Edwards. He taught German, as it happens, German and Latin. And I think his hobby was putting people in detention. He used to walk around the corridors, you boy. And he did, he talked just like that, okay. And he was balder than I am, with a metal plate in his head, so we were all scared stiff of him, And it was his hobby, was like catching us out and putting us in detention for next to nothing. And I think we have a view of God like that sometimes, don't we? That actually we think he's out there just to catch us out, to find ways to punish us, find ways to be nasty, find ways to be unjust and unfair and uncaring. And sadly, we've cultivated that as the church for so many years. But when Jesus came, he introduced something different, I believe, actually, I think. When Jesus taught us to pray, he taught us to start prayer with "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name." There's a huge amount of theology wrapped up in that. One is that, this idea that God is paternal, and yet he is also, we're meant to respect him. It's intimacy with respect, isn't it? There's two extremes with how we view God. One is that he's up there with a big stick. The other is that he's some sort of cuddly granddaddy figure who doesn't really want to bother us about anything. And both, you think about it in terms of parenting, both are not really working. Either parent who is always, always harsh. That doesn't really cultivate great parenting, does it? Great. And the other one who never challenges in their child and always lets the child just do whatever they want, and their kid becomes the monster at playgroup. that's the two extremes, isn't it? And Jesus walks into that and says, talk to God as Father. And he changed the narrative. He changed the conversation about God. Jesus, every time he prayed in the Gospels, he told God Father, apart from one occasion. Every time he prayed, he addressed God as Father. He opened a different narrative. He opened a different conversation. He took us into the conversation of family, that we relate to God on the basis of family language, of intimacy. Now, I know that in our broken world, those words mean different things to different people, and sometimes they're not strong words. So that's why I think Jesus said, our Father in heaven. In other words, the perfect Father, the one who can reinvent the things or can restore the words and the language that we might not find easy, particularly when it comes to paternal words. So in that sense, I think what Jesus was doing was he was shifting this view of God as being the one out there to rule-based, aggressive, to the one who wants intimacy with us. And it's interesting that as the New Testament writers progressed, they carried this same thought into the New Testament. And Paul writes about, says that we can address God as Abba, Father. The word Abba in the language of that day was a bit like calling God Daddy, like the little baby language. Daddy, Daddy. So they walked this language forward and they got hold of this. The only time that Jesus didn't call God Father was when he was on the cross and clothed with the sin and the failings and the weaknesses of humanity. And in that moment when he was clothed on our behalf before God with all the filth of humanity, all the things that we do that hurt one another, that damage our relationships, that hurt ourselves. And he was clothed with all of that in that moment when he took, as the Bible says, in his body on the tree, he took our sin and our failings. That in that moment, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it seems to me that as he is clothed with sin, that somehow that damages that intimacy and language and relationship with God. And so in our walk in God and the way that we manage our expectation and grow our resources, if you like, to come back to the theme of the parable and the talents, how do we talk to God? Do we think of a God who is willing to let us make mistakes and still love us? Yes, we do. It's when we sin that somehow or another we step back from that relationship that says that God is loving and kind towards us. God's not out to catch us out and hit us with a stick when we get it wrong. He's out to let us make mistakes and pick us up and lead us forward and walk with us and be with us. These theologies that teach that God does everything and we don't have much to do in it. What that basically sort of says is that we don't really matter, doesn't it, in many ways. But actually, I think what the Bible teaches is a God who invests in us. A God who says, what you do is significant and will make a difference, and I'll help you and I'll walk with you, but I ain't going to do it for you. You're going to have to do it with me, or it ain't going to work. Equally, we see a God in this story who says, the worst thing that you did was to do nothing. I could have walked with you. I could have rewarded you if you'd at least tried something. God is a God who is keener on us taking risks and failing than doing nothing at all. People say that the journey to success is a journey littered with failures. If you can't fail, you can't succeed. Have a go. Make a difference. So there's lots more I'd like to say, really. How do we know about God? We see him in nature, we're told. We see him predictably in the scriptures. We see him in the stories that we carry in science. Science and faith are not in conflict, by the way. They're just two parts of the same journey. But particularly, we know about God because we see him in Jesus. When Jesus said, if you've seen me, you have seen the Father, he basically was saying, you have seen what God is like when you see how I live. So when we see Jesus empowering the disempowered, when we see him loving the unlovely, when we see him challenging religious nonsense, when we see him suffering for the sins of humanity, We're saying, hey, this is what God is like. This is what God is like. And I love this thought, really, a God who cares enough about people to become a person. So when we're thinking about how we use our resources, to come back to the point, okay. It seems to me that this story is impregnated with the challenge that says, if you want to use what God has given you well, have a good view of God. Have a view, a healthy view of God. A God who is going to walk with you as you try to do things for him. A God who's prepared to pick you up when you fall down. A God who is in love with you and in love with the world around you. And a God who is helping you shape your values. A God who is going to help you over those lazy moments when you think, oh, I just can't be bothered. And go, come on, let's go. Let's do this. A God who is in love with humanity. What I find interesting about Jesus' approach to thinking about end times is that he doesn't sugarcoat things, does he? He tells us there will be wars, there will be rumours of wars, there will be awful things happening in the world around us. He doesn't sugarcoat that. And at least God's honest with us, even if we have trouble with that, thinking, why doesn't God stop all this? The point is, he will one day, by the way. That's the whole point of this language of second coming and of the kingdom to come and of a heaven to be, is that he will stop it all one day, but it's just not going to happen just yet. So in the middle of all that, we have got to think about how we're going to wait, how we're going to live, how we're going to behave as we wait for this second coming of Jesus. And these stories, it seems to me, to be impregnated with that idea of how are you going to live as you wait for the second coming of Jesus? Are you going to be somebody who cultivates a relationship with God? If you hear nothing out of these last few weeks, hear that. That the heart of what God is looking for in us is relationship. God is a relational God. Relationship. He's going to be looking to see whether you cultivated that friendship with him, that relationship with him. He's going to be looking if you have responsibilities, how you've used your responsibilities. If we'd got onto the parable and the sheep and the goats, we'd have been thinking about, he'd have been looking to see how you've cared about your fellow human being in social action and care, and what have you done? And in this story of the power of the talents, he's going to be looking to see what have you done to contribute towards heaven coming on earth now. How have you used your resources? Jesus taught us to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, which seems to me to go to the heart of this story, that part of what God expects for us is that we are living heaven this side of eternity. That we are living heaven now and we are seeking to bring something of that down. And that can reflect in the use of the resources that he gives to us. Let's just pray, shall we? Guys, do you want to come and lead us as well? One more song, if that's okay. I've probably spoken for longer than I should, but it's, yeah. Whilst we're just sitting in a moment of silence, it may be that either today or over the last few weeks, as we've talked about these things, that you found yourself thinking, you know, I want this relationship with God. I really do want this relationship with God. Can I invite us all just to close our eyes, if that's okay, to respect one another's privacy, just for a few moments, and just close our eyes. And if there's something in you that has just resonated with that thought, that you're saying, you know, I want this Jesus, I want to know him. I want it to be more than just going to church and reading and getting to know Christians, as great as all that may be. I want to know this Jesus. I want to ask you, just where you sit, just to put your hand, just very brief, you know, don't have to be right up in the air, just put it up as a way of saying to God, God, I choose you. I choose you. Father, thank you for those that are stretching out for you today, Lord. I pray this week that in their journey, in their work, that this week, Lord, that they would know something more of you in a deeper way. Whereas they pray, it will be like heaven opens to them. And they have that moment, God, where they know you. Where obstacles come and try to restrict that, Lord, I pray you help them to move past those obstacles. And Lord, I pray for all of us this morning that we would know you more, Jesus. That, Lord, we would be able to pray that prayer with sincerity. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth. Now, as it is in heaven.